Joss, how you doing today, man? It's we were just talking about it before we hopped on the recording, but it's hot out here, and we were saying that if we were in this book, like I think it would be worse because I would just be like just straight up like drinking like flask of whiskey, walking around. Just
back in the day when like the food pyramid was a thing, right? They would tell you like, hey, drink 8 glasses of water a day, right? And years and years and like degrees Celsius of climate change later, right? Now you hear, okay, 3 to 4 glasses an hour depending on the weather, all of which to say, like this book's pretty much scuppered my plans to go wandering in the Mexican desert because I would not last a day.
Well, if you are going to be going and wandering in the wilderness, if you are going to be going, you might want to have some knowledge of herbal lore. You might want to have some knowledge of plants and stuff. And for that reason, well, actually not really for that reason, but just in general, because we like him here, we're bringing back, he's the first guest that's now first recurring guest now on the
Yo.
Socialist Shelf. We've got Drew Mason here, come back on the show. Welcome back.
Thank you guys. I appreciate you having me. I'm always down for this. I love it. And I'm holding on to
Yes.
that title. I'm proud of
Oh
it.
yeah.
Oh
Well,
yeah.
get like a, I think 3 times you get a challenge coin or something like
Okay. Yeah,
that.
yeah, yeah. Let's work something
I
out.
just made that up, but
Yeah,
yeah.
3 times
So
challenge coin, 1 year shelfer coin, 2 year shelfer coin. By the
Y'all
way,
be
invest in
tired of
shelf
me.
coin, y'all.
Do not. It's the worst. I did have somebody ask me. He said you could have like you could have if you had merch, which we're a long way from that, but if you had it could be like shelf life or something like that. And
Shelf
it's
life.
ooh,
shelf life.
okay. There you
Yeah.
go.
That
And I
sounds
was
like
like,
some bougie bottled water for like readers.
I guess. I was trying to think of puns on it though. Like you have like shelfie, like a selfie, but I don't know what you do with that. I don't know. I'm not good at this. There's a reason I'm not like a marketing or advertising guy.
And hey, every June, young man, put your pride on the shelf.
Oh my God. There you go. There you go. How you doing, Drew? How you doing?
I am living and living pretty good today. I got to take my babies out for a dirt magic class by the river.
There you go.
I unfortunately had to deal with an onslaught of folks because it is that time. Good God, they are swarming in droves here in the Great Smoky Mountains. It is a madhouse out there. But we found a little quiet spot by the river, found a bunch of cool stuff, found a bunch of mushrooms, found some chanterelles getting started. They ain't quite ready yet. That rain, I think, is what's got them popping. But yeah, I was real happy to see that. But yeah, I had a good day. Any day out in the woods by the river with the babies and the wife playing with mushrooms and plants. I mean, shit. I ain't gonna ask for nothing more than
Yeah, nothing wrong
that.
with that. No,
100%.
I grew up in Tennessee for a long time, and people would always say stuff along times of like, oh, Tennessee, all the hills and stuff. Well, I'm from Middle Tennessee is the problem. So it's just flat. It's plateau, basically. I mean,
I cannot stand, I'll be honest with you. Well, it's a lot to do with Nashville. It's because I just hate Nashville.
yeah, I wasn't in
But
Nashville, but I was closer to Nashville. Everywhere, anywhere. The thing about Nashville is if you're an hour out of Nashville, you can see it because there's no hills leading
there's
up to
nothing
the place.
else.
So my kind of like signal for whenever I'm driving through Nashville, because I go up to Kentucky a lot, is like I'll be 20 minutes or so outside the city, and my music is jacked into like my radio via a fucking like Bluetooth thing, and I'll just start hearing a sermon all of a sudden, and that'll last until a little after Nashville because there just happens to be Christian radio on that particular channel that I use for my Bluetooth, and no shade on that, but like every so often Jesus just hijacks my phone.
You come through Nashville, it's what you're gonna listen to, buddy.
That's how I know. That's how I know.
I do think they've got those interstate posters that say Jesus is calling, will you answer or whatever. I think that's literally what's happening to you.
It's
I think
funny
I've seen that.
because it Middle Tennessee has always reminded me of that stretch you hit when you're coming up. Yeah, I was born in Mobile, Alabama, lived the first half of my life down in Mobile, and well, 10 years. But that stretch coming out of Mobile, going up to Montgomery and then on up to Birmingham, that middle part of Alabama, it reminds me of Middle Tennessee. It's just alike. And that is where that famous go to church or the devil will get you sign is, is on that route on the interstate. And there's a bunch of signs like that. And you will, if you got the radio playing, that's what you're going to get hitting that little stretch right there.
We got a sign.
It's similar. I mean, me and Joss are in Georgia now, and I think West Georgia, you can really lump in there too. It's a very similar type of land. Mm-hmm. You really could have your own, like, honestly, like, yeah, in just that region, you could just have a sort of region where not a whole lot is, but you know, it's got its stuff to it. It's all like its highway curiosities.
I mean, there's a lot of cool forests and a lot of really fertile ground out there. But when I was doing surveying work, I saw what they were doing out there. They build these crazy chemical factories out there that are the size of cities. It's wild, dude. Like you drive for an hour, you'll see nothing. And then all of a sudden there's this Blade Runner looking fucking structure.
Yeah.
It's crazy, dude.
Dude, literally in South Georgia right now, which is, it's a little different because you've got more swamps and stuff. It's still very, you know, very rural and very open. You've got right now, and not to get it too far off topic, but because you've got so few people living down there. And I'm not talking about like Savannah. I'm talking about like closer to somewhere like Folkestone and really Finoki and stuff. Because when, aside from Savannah, there's nothing down there. There's Valdosta. There's a few people, but really there's just not a lot. They already built it. It's an ICE immigrant detention facility. Get this. And so they already built that. They're building it right now. They just announced they're going to turn it into the biggest ICE detention facility in the United States in South Georgia.
Jesus.
And they can do it because they got it. They're building in a town of like something like 1500 people, 1500 people across. I don't even know how many square miles. And these people don't have a Walmart. They don't have a hospital. So you're talking about that made me think of that. And they're doing that while they're
so wild.
Starting to strip mine the Okefenokee. They just signed off on that last year.
I saw that.
Crazy shit,
yeah, it's crazy. It's like, oh yeah, we got all this land. It could be growing stuff. What's the most horrifying shit we can build on it?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. No, yeah, we went down there, or I went down there a few months ago to talk to some folks who live in the area. None of them like it. None of them like the idea. Well, we ran into a few cops. They liked it, but they got moved out there for it. Literally nobody though. We went to the trailer park, which was really the only like homes there where like you had the trailer park and you have where like the cops and prison people live.
Yep.
And nobody at the trailer park liked it. There was the trailer park and a few old houses that had not been repaired in years. But anyway, I'm not trying to get us too far off topic, but I think I can loop it together a little bit because some of this darkness we see here in Blood Meridian, that darkness that McCarthy invites us to look into, man, it didn't go
anywhere.
That's
what it is.
Lives in the dirt.
That's it. I mean, that really is a great point because, I mean, it's the same kind of thing. The tactics have changed.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? It's become a lot more palatable for the media, you know?
The language perhaps has changed, you know? But
yeah.
But
the things they're doing now, the funny thing is when I look and I see, they're strip mining the Okefenokee. Oh, they're, you know, building Cop City in Atlanta. Oh, they're, you know, building these chemical plants. They're burning down, you know, the Smokies and stuff. When I see that, I can't help but think, this is what the characters in Blood Meridian like spilled their blood for to win this. Like, it's crazy. Like that, all that sacrifice, I mean, horrible sacrifice, terrible things, but all that, you know, just horrible war, not to build some paradise or even an idea of a paradise.
Oh yeah. Like, y'all
take what was good about the land even further.
Y'all ever read King Leopold's Ghost?
I'm familiar. I've not read it.
It's the one that's about like the Congo Free State, like the colony that Belgium set up that was basically just like the King of Belgium's personal property and all the horrible shit that went down there. And you know, you send your lowlifes, you send your disinherited third sons who were you know not got anything else going for him down to Africa, right? And you tell them, okay, you're better than these people. You can do whatever you want from them. And what do you get? You get people sodomizing people with dynamite.
Yeah.
Yep.
Literally. Yeah. Now imagine that book. Imagine like that book written from those people's perspective. You pretty much got Blood Meridian.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, that's exactly it. And like the principles, the core of it, you know, is it's all the same. It comes back to the same thing. And the judge discusses it, you know, in detail a lot of time. And as do other characters, they, you know, there's definitely a lot to, it's unapologetic in its depiction of, you know, that thing. And as I was saying on Twitter before, that is the American way. That is American values, in my opinion, doubt. As I see it.
No doubt.
You know, growing up here.
All righty. Yeah, absolutely. And to give it, so that's an overview right there. That's what we're getting into. If you haven't picked up on it yet from what we're saying, from the episode title, from wherever you got this from, we're talking about Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian. At the time of this recording, it's been how long now since Cormac McCarthy passed? Just a couple weeks.
Yeah, I think 2 weeks. Something like that.
Yeah, yeah, it's not been very long. It's been less than a month. Mm-hmm. You know, and we're going to talk about him. We always intended to talk about him, but we moved up our timeline a little bit because it seemed timely, you know. Really, and we can talk about this later, but he was kind of the guy that when I was in college, if he was the easy answer, you said, who's the greatest living American author? It was just the easy answer you could throw out. I don't think it's so easy an answer now to throw out now, but
no.
Especially since Toni Morrison died a few years ago too. Mm-hmm. She could have worked too, but we can talk more about that. But let's talk about Cormac McCarthy himself before we dive into this book. And Joss, I think you've got a basic overview, though I'm sure both of us will also have our inputs here and there. So Joss, take it away.
Yeah. It's I have kind of a rambling rough timeline here. So yeah, feel free to interject.
Rambling rough timeline just kind of describes his prose in general.
That is literally, and his life too. I mean, that's how he gets down.
Yeah. And by choice, you know. Charles Joseph McCarthy Jr. That was his birth name, and he was born. He actually shares a birthday with me. He was born July 20th, 1933, in Providence, Rhode Island. Listeners of the podcast may remember that as H.P. Lovecraft country. And he was one of six kids from an Irish Catholic family. And this family moved to Texas in 1937. So he was 4 years old at the time. His dad worked as a lawyer for the Tennessee Valley Authority. And he lived most of his childhood in South Knoxville. His childhood home, I found out, actually burned down in 2009. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, we lost that little bit of history. Yep. And the family had land, they had woods, they had maids in their homes, so they were fairly well off. McCarthy himself said, I'm leaning kind of heavily on his first like major like publicity kind of interview with the New York Times in 1992.
He didn't give a lot of those, worth noting.
No, he did not. He did not. But he said, we were considered rich because all the people around us were living in one or two room shacks. So kind of well off for the time for his area. And he went to Catholic school. He didn't see the point in going to school. He said, and this is a mood, I felt early on I wasn't going to be a respectable citizen.
Hell yeah. That's my boy.
Yes, sir. You know, he had plenty of hobbies. You know, he got into, you know, he said he had 40 or 50 hobbies, right? And, you know, he could have given a hobby to everybody in his class and still gone home with a couple of dozen, right? So, you know, certainly a man of many interests. He studied physics and engineering, though, at the University of Tennessee from 1951. He loses interest. He drops out in 53. And that's where he has his first encounter with his first kind of interest in writing is sparked. A professor has him edit a book of 18th century essays for punctuation. Which, I mean, Jacob, I know you've, I don't know, Mason, if you've been in like the copy editing space, but that just sounds tedious.
Yeah,
oh, man.
Yeah.
Especially that old language. It's like, is that supposed to be there? Is he meaning that?
Before this was standardized, yeah.
But you can feel that in his work a little bit, though, that like, I'm going to do what I want with punctuation. Like, it punctuation works for me. I don't work for punctuation. So, you know.
Yeah, well, yep. and indeed, you know, somebody who does deep dives into that kind of material. Although I wasn't able to find out what exactly the essays were about. Maybe I will someday. So he described himself as having, as I said, just about every hobby there ever was. He didn't really, really discover literature till he was 23. Now, at that time, he joined the Air Force. He served from 1953 to 57. He returned to college in 57. He majored in English. And at this time, he publishes two short stories, Wake for Susan and A Drowning Incident, in the student literary magazine. He wins a grant from an arts foundation for creative writing for both, at which point he drops out in 59. By this time, he decided to write for a living, and he changed his name to Cormac, which is a family nickname from a couple of aunts of his. And there's a couple of explanations out there as to why. My favorite is that he did it to avoid confusion with this famous ventriloquist dummy at the time named Charlie McCarthy.
Wow.
Apparently ventriloquism was big.
That's wild.
So he drops out in 59. He starts writing for a living. In 61, he marries his first wife, Lee Holloman. And they move to a shack in the Smoky Mountains. And they have a son, Cullen. And fairly shortly after that, she divorces him because he, as I understand it, he wanted her to get a day job on top of taking care of the baby and on top of the chores around the house so he could focus on his writing.
Yeah, so he was not, pretty famous for that. You know, I mean, even like you hear folks talk about him around here, you're just as likely to hear like, it's a good thing he could write. Because he
went,
what the fuck?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, because that's the thing, right? He said himself, you know, I always knew that I didn't want to work. You have to be dedicated, but, you know, writing was his number one priority.
Worked hard, not working. I like that.
Exactly. You know, and as we'll discuss, you know, he spent some fairly long periods with not a whole lot. From that New York Times interview I mentioned, he was asked if he ever paid alimony for his various divorces. And his response was, with what?
Yeah. Honestly, yeah.
So, but fortunately for him, 4 years later in 65, Random House picks up his first book, which is The Orchard Keeper. And he says himself, it was the only publisher I had heard of.
Yeah. I love that. So,
again, you know, like one shot, one kill, right?
Yep. Yeah.
It's praised for its similarity at the time to Faulkner's work. It actually gets noticed by Faulkner's final editor, who himself went on to edit McCarthy for 20 years, and it wins another award from the Faulkner Foundation. And he basically lives on award grant money most of the time from various literary foundations. You know, which again, you know, it's. Between those, it's you have a sense of how rough it is, because at one point at this time he's kicked out of a room in New Orleans for non-payment of rent. That room was $40 a month.
Wow.
Which, you know, 1960s money, 1970s money is different, but still
it's still not a lot though.
Yeah, still not a lot. So, but 65, he wins a traveling fellowship award that year from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. And he goes to Ireland on this money, and it's on the trip over that he meets his second wife, Anne Delisle. Mm. They're married the following year. Same year, 1966, he gets a Rockefeller Foundation grant. He travels to Europe on this grant. They land in Ibiza, where he writes his second book in 1968, Outer Dark.
Oh, yeah.
And
which is so crazy to me. I'm just, to think, reading Outer Dark and thinking that he wrote it in sunny Ibiza or whatever. Like, what the fuck is going on in your head, bro?
This is a guy who spends a lot of time staring at walls. You know what I mean? Like,
does he write in just like a dark, like in a dark, cold room with right. You know, no windows and like, why go to Ibiza to do that?
You know, I mean, he got the inspiration for The Road from, like, you know, just looking out of a motel window. You know, he could have done that anywhere.
Yeah.
one assumes. I don't know. But so in 1969, they go back to Louisville, Tennessee from Ibiza, and they move into a dairy barn, which McCarthy himself renovated. And okay.
Like with his own hands or like.
Yeah, with his own hands. Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah. So, you know, he did, you know, He was handy, you know. He did chores.
You know, his wife loved that too. She's like, "All right, so when you want to invade a dairy barn?"
this was incredible to me. So his wife was interviewed later, and she said, "I mean, Jacob, you said that she provided the caveat that, you know, McCarthy was upfront about who he was and what kind of lifestyle that he led. You know, you knew what you were getting into, kind of, but." She also said in that interview, somebody would call him up and offer him $2,000 to come speak at a university about his books. And he would tell them that everything he had to say was there on the page. So he would eat beans for another week.
Yep.
If there's gangster shit in the fucking, in the writing community, you know, like that is it right there. I mean, yep. Like. Oh God!
Oh yeah, I mean, here's a guy who doesn't do the whole literary circuit thing. You know, he doesn't do lectures, he doesn't do book signings. He's you know, not interested in all that. He's just writing because he feels that he has to. You know, this is what he does.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, and it does really speak for itself. I mean, let's be real. Like, he knew what he was doing. He knew, and I've heard him say, you know, I always knew that I could write. You know,
yeah,
because you know, he was especially around here. Like he was a raconteur, man. Like, you know, mm-hmm. Just if he was talking, then it was a cool story, and it was, and you were going to want to listen to it. You know, so like he was always going to do, he knew from just talking to people that he could always enthrall them, you know? Mm. And if he, and when he wanted money, he could, you know, turn that, that intrigue into money, you know. I guess mm-hmm. when you feel that powerful and you just know you got it like that.
Fuck. What's notable to me is I videos you do see of him, what interviews he does have. So often he is a great storyteller, but he is so very rarely still talking about himself and his own work, even when he is talking. Yeah. He loves to refer to other writers, he loves stuff in the rare interviews. So it is interesting. There is like this it's not that he's not willing to be introspective. It's just that his works are already so introspective, already telling you so much.
That's a good point.
Like you said, it's there on the page, man. You know,
yeah.
You can find really examples to the contrary. It's not a hard rule, but just in general, you know.
Yeah.
So it's in that barn that he writes Child of God in 1973, which, as I understand, is might go even harder than Blood Meridian.
No. No.
I've not read Child of God, so I don't know.
I really, 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 really like Child of God a lot. And it makes sense, you know, that he was in a dingy old dairy barn that he rebuilt, you know, when he was writing it. And I'm not going to tell you, I'm not going to sit here and say that it's not dark,
mm-hmm.
And gruesome in parts, but it's, and gross. In parts, there's a lot more that's just, I would say it's it leans heavy on the disturbing side of things and the gross side of things pretty well, because it's just, it's like unapologetically raw how people are, you know, and the things that aren't normally described about their everyday life and functions. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It gets into some of that kind of stuff, so mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it's, you know, if you're squeamish for violence and stuff, it's not going to hit you. It's not as violent as Blood Meridian, of course. But it is dark, but I wouldn't say a lot of people go really heavy and say, oh, it's so dark, stay away from it. And I just like to kind of push back on that a little bit, because it's so great. And yeah, another one that's very important for the times, in my opinion. It's a character study on what all these little weird little boys online, you know, talking shit to women all day. I mean, it is.
Yeah.
It's about them. you know.
Yeah, I'm glad that's a good word for it. I think character study. I mean, maybe I just had that kind of prejudice going into it because it's more of an intimate kind of tale. You spend so much more time alone with this person.
Right.
We'll do Child of God one day. So they stick it out, he and his second wife, until 76. McCarthy actually leaves Delisle and moves to El Paso. And he's there for 3 years. He writes Sutri in 1979, which he'd been actually working on and off for 20 years. It's based in large part on his own life, his experiences, and people he met. Also in the 70s, he's contacted by PBS to write an episode about a drama series called Visions. Mm-hmm. And the episode, The Gardener's Son, is about a mill worker who ultimately kills his tyrannical boss. And that's where I kind of got the first hint of the political in his writing, because he's very, apart from Blood Meridian, of course, because he himself is very private with his politics, from what I was able to find.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which I don't know if he just didn't think that was too terribly important to the interpretation of his work.
I don't know. To me, it seems like that would have been one of those things that he specifically didn't, I don't know, maybe that's what he was talking about. Like, it's there on the page. What you can discern from the page, you know, is how I feel about it. And maybe, you know, not getting into like hard explanations is a way to keep the conversation open with everybody. You know what I'm saying? Right. Which is what you have to do if you are a raconteur in Knoxville, Tennessee, you know what I'm saying? Like, you got to be able to, discuss, you got to be able to tell the horrors of war as they truly are while still, you know, not letting folks know that you're anti-war or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, you, they, folks around here, politics, it's one of those things, I guess you find it everywhere, but here in the South, especially, in a place where it's very mixed and always has been, in Knoxville, going all the way back to the Civil damn war, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's why I feel like, you know, you don't get any like hard outright explanations of his politics. I think that was on purpose, you know, to keep it open, you know, so it couldn't be like couldn't be nailed down by anybody else trying to tell, you know, explain something about him that he didn't explain himself. He didn't want people doing that, you know.
Right, because once you have a label, you know, then it's, you know, indelibly kind of your stuff is looked at through that label, you know. And right. And maybe that's what you intend, but you know, also maybe there's a stuff written on the page that you want people to, you know, consider.
And it seems like a lot of what he's writing about, he's more interested in what was, in a lot of ways.
Yep.
You know, just, it's just what interests him, you know, like in everything, really. Like, I mean, even when you read, you know, something like The Road or No Country for Old Men, that's like either modern or in the future, in the case of The Road, it still feels like what was, you know, or it's all calling back to something previous. In a way that is just more more interested in origins and roots than it really is in the concept of the future.
I'm gonna put a pin in that because I feel like we could talk about that when we get into the text.
You're right. Carry on, because I know you have a little bit more bit more bio here.
No, and so does my cat, if you heard her, but you know,
I know that
we've mutually agreed that her opinion doesn't count. In 1981, he's awarded a MacArthur Fellowship, and it's worth $236,000.
Mm.
And it is on that he travels the Southwest to research Blood Meridian.
Mm.
And from then on to at least the early 90s, by the way, he lives in a stone cottage behind a shopping center in El Paso, which he self-identifies as barely habitable.
Wow.
So you think,
by his standards.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. You think a guy who eats off a hot plate, cuts his own hair, you know, lives a very Spartan lifestyle in the first place, what he would describe as barely habitable, right? Wow. And so Blood Meridian drops in 1985. And by this time, it's not exactly clear just how much of a sensation he would become. Because again, that New York Times article that I mentioned, it only drops in 1992, the month before All the Pretty Horses comes out.
Yeah, that's right. His first huge financial success, or market success. Obviously, he's done well. He's impressed the foundation people and more, but like the reading public. I think it's All the Pretty Horses is the first one that does numbers.
Right. Because up till then, you know, he's essentially a writer's writer, as he's described.
Yeah.
You know, before All the Pretty Horses, right, none of his novels sold more than 5,000 copies in hardcover. None.
Yeah.
For most of his career, he didn't even have an agent.
In fact, the original, some of the reviews from the 80s of Blood Meridian just don't get it at all. They're just not. A lot of people don't get it now, but like they don't get it in the way of they're like, he's just trying to impress us with how dark he is. And it's like, he's not trying to impress anybody. Nope. He might be trying to depress you. But anyway, yeah, go ahead, Josh. Sorry.
Yeah. No, you're good. You're good. You know, you're absolutely right. His first major recognition comes from that, from All the Pretty Horses that year. So he wins the National Book Award. He wins the National Book Critics Circle Award. He goes from not selling 5,000 hardcover copies of any of his books to selling 190,000 copies of All the Pretty Horses in 6 months.
Oh, yeah.
Huge.
Yeah. Huge.
He follows up with The Crossing in 94, Cities of the Plain in 98, a play, The Stonemason, between that in 95. He writes No Country for Old Men in 2005. It's adapted by the Coen brothers into the film 2 years later, which is an amazing turnaround to me.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Wait, he wrote that in 2005. I thought it was a little older, actually.
I did too.
It feels older.
I mean, again, you know, Cormac McCarthy is one of those people that you're kind of surprised is still around, you know, like who feels much out of another time.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's true.
And between that time, he releases The Road in 2006.
Oh, yeah.
And as we mentioned, as we kind of touched on, he gets the idea for the book while he's staying in a motel with his son from his third wife. He married her in 97, divorced her in 06 while they lived north of Santa Fe. She doesn't really enter into it. But the son does. It's adapted for the screen in 2011. I believe that's when the Oprah interview is from. It's no, I'm wrong. It's selected for Oprah's book club for April 2007.
Yeah.
And he says that, yeah, you know, literally without his son, without thinking about, you know, where he and his son would be in, you know, if the whole world went to hell, right? You know, it wouldn't be a book. It wouldn't have happened.
Right.
You can see it from reading it too. Like that. That's the one that gets me. That's the one that oh God, that's rough. I read it regularly, but that's still the darkest one for me.
The Road has my, I've said it before, Road has my favorite ending, I think, of any book. Like the favorite, last two paragraphs, or maybe any book ever. Oh. But, and then The Road, he didn't write another book for it was 2006 till last year, The Passenger and Stella Maris came out together, right?
Yeah.
I haven't read those ones yet, I confess.
That was after, by this time, he spent pretty much the rest of his life hanging out at the Santa Fe Institute, which is a nonprofit research center for various scientists in various fields. He's one of the only non-scientists there.
What was he doing there?
Just hanging out, shooting the shit with scientists, doing more writing and research, following up on his interests. Like he himself said that writing, you know, as much of a passion as he has for writing, like it's so far down his list of like just general interests. Like he's a big science guy. He's a big history guy. He's a big philosophy guy. And
The Passenger is about the atomic bomb, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is.
The Passenger. Yeah, have either of y'all read the two new ones yet?
No. I have not. No. I have, The Passenger, but I'm not ready for it yet.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
I'm not ready for it yet. I have heard a lot of really, really good things.
Yeah, everybody liked it. Everybody liked both of them. So I'll read them. I was just curious. Josh, I feel like you would have mentioned if you had.
No, I mean, Blood Meridian.
Oh, yeah, you already said this was your first McCarthy. So.
Yep, never read another word that he's written. But you know, we picked some fantastic ones to start with. Certainly.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
If you have that, when does it say anything about the Sunset Limited when he wrote that?
Sunset Limited.
Yeah, which was a play.
Oh yes,
and then
yes.
HBO did a movie out of it with Sam L. and Tommy Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fucking incredible.
I think Sunset Limited premiered in 2006. I know, in Chicago.
So he had that running on the stage same year that he put out The Road.
Jeez,
wow,
what a year!
Yeah. And then I'm looking at the movie. Yeah,
I thought it was great.
2011, so the movie was 4 years afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's funny. It was Tommy Lee Jones and Samuel L. Jackson. It's a duo second collaboration after Rules of Engagement. And he wrote the screenplay as well.
Have y'all seen it? Have y'all?
I've not seen it.
Oh,
it's got to go on my list now.
Yeah,
Jacob,
yeah,
we need to see it. You particularly, my friend, with your your philosophies on religion and things. Oh my gosh, it is right up your alley.
I gotta see it, man.
So good, yeah.
I'm starring the Wikipedia page, so I see it.
Just two dudes in a room talking too. That's all. Oh, that's it. Just two dudes having a conversation. That's it. Oh my God, it's so good.
Oh, man, yeah, I got to do that. I got to watch that. But yeah, and it seems that he wrote the screenplay as well as the play. So, I mean, they're probably pretty similar based on my understanding of the movie. But
yeah.
Cool. And then Joss, you said he spent that time at the foundation and then passed away just a few weeks ago, right?
Yeah, final stuff on that. 2014 to 2023. I mean, he lives, as I understand, pretty much the life that a lot of writers dream of living. You know, just surrounded by really interesting people in fields that you're interested in. And kind of absorbing that and eventually translating that into some kind of narrative. He died at his home on the 13th of June. At the age of 89. Good long life. And, you know, with its ups and downs, certainly.
He did it. Yeah.
Yeah. Entirely on his own terms. You know, he didn't do email. You know, he never voted because he said that poets shouldn't vote.
do you know about the Cormac McCarthy Twitter hoax?
I was just about to say that. Yes.
Oh, go ahead.
There were a couple of hoax Twitter accounts in the past decade pretending to be him.
And a couple of them got verified. This is pre Elon Musk, when just anybody, any dipshit.
Well, yeah. There was a 2016 one as well where actually, the USA Today picked this up. They tweeted that he died. And the origin of it happened to be some Italian guy who, you know, does these hoaxes to make a point about social media misinformation. But yeah, like the way that his publisher, his agent were able to debunk the faux accounts pretending to be him in particular was they came out and said, look, he doesn't own a computer.
I had heard that. That dude, he hauled around a typewriter everywhere he went.
Just, which sold at auction in 2009 for $250,000.
Wow. So what did he write his last two books on, I wonder? Must have had to get another typewriter.
Typewriter. He went and bought an exact same one. I heard that story too. He went and bought the exact same one for like $40 at a pawn shop or something.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Do y'all know anything about the papers they were letting him do at the Santa Fe Institute, or like what he was there? There's the only one I know about is one of the most interesting, and it's just like a perfect bit of Cormac, like something that only he would think about and want to write about. And I could see the conversation, you know, when he's talking to these physicists and stuff, you know, told him about it. And they were like, dude, yes, write a paper on that right now, bro. Please.
Is it the one about like the unconscious mind and human language and how one is like one's constructed and the other is like not?
Yes. Very, very cool. Very, very interesting. Very interesting stuff. It was wild that he just, that's how he got to, you know, spend his time. I'm just going to think of cool shit, tell my genius friends about it, you know, bounce it off them, and then write something cool about it.
Was that the Kekulé problem? Is that how you say it? Kekulé problem?
Yeah.
Kekulé?
Yeah. Yeah, Kekulé. Kool-Aid man.
Yeah, I remember that. That was a few years ago, right? Like 2016, 2017?
It was a while back that I'd heard about it. I don't remember all the details or, you know, exactly. I just remember sitting there like, what? How do you think of stuff like what are you doing, man? Like, I remember when I seen it, all I'd known was that I didn't know anything about the Santa Fe Institute. I didn't know that he was just hanging out with those type dudes at the time. So I was just like, how does this dude, what is going on in this dude's head that he's, you know, writing Blood Meridian and Child of God, and then now he's doing stuff like this? Like, what a brain, man.
Dude, this is funny to me. I just read this. I was looking up about the typewriter I was interested in, and get this. So the typewriter was auctioned in 2009 to raise money for the Santa Fe Institute. Get this. It says the auction house, and this comes from the New York Times. The auction house estimated it would fetch between $15,000 and $20,000. It sold for over $254,000, all money to the Santa Fe, and McCarthy replaced it with an identical model bought for him by his friend John Miller for $11 plus $19.95 for shipping.
Okay, yeah, I said $40, so that was plus the shipping.
And so it's funny. His friend John, quoting the New York Times, they originally said $11. He said, no, I also paid another $19.95 for shipping. You got to put that on there. We had to do a correction. And that is so funny to me. You know, that's exactly the kind of guy I imagine hanging out with, Cormac McCarthy. Tells the New York Times, hey, you better note my $20 I put down for shipping.
Well, you know, it's as I understand it, that's just kind of the guy he was. You know, he said himself, I have this quote here, science is very rigorous. When you hang out with scientists and you see how they think, you can't do so without developing respect for it. And part of what you respect is their rigor. When you say something, it needs to be right. You can't just speculate idly about things.
Yeah. There you go.
Yep. That's how he gets down. That's wild.
Yeah. And that kind of translates into the Jacob, you were telling me about this earlier, right? The exactitude of his prose, right? The very careful selection of each word for its particular purpose and its place in the prose. Not unlike Lovecraft. That was the first thing I thought of.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are some similarities, I think, in the way that the landscapes are described. Yes, that I feel that in the very hyper precision. I mean, I do think I do like him a lot better, like his prose a lot better than Lovecraft's personally.
Yes,
but I get what you're saying with that.
He's not afraid to use words that have roots in languages other than Anglo-Saxon.
Sure. Yeah.
right.
The last thing I wanted to do before we really get into talking about the book is, Joss, you already mentioned this was your first real experience with McCarthy. I'm sure you'd heard of him plenty, but this was your first thing by him. Drew, if you wanted to talk a little bit, we know some of this, but if you wanted to talk a little bit about your background with McCarthy based on, and you mentioned it briefly about, where you come from and your relationship with his work, then that would be awesome.
Yeah. Being from the Knoxville area, it's just like we were trailer park kids. None of us were particularly well read outside of the King James, and you know, that might have been another reason why we gravitated toward him so much. But we weren't really reading much, but he was the hometown hero. And you hear stories, you meet people. He was so popular, and there's so many people that know him around here. From just being he was running the roads, He was
the road,
all of them.
Sorry.
he did every, he lived, constantly doing cool shit and being around, interesting people. And so you'll see old heads all the time. Like I said before, some of them would be like, he could write and tell a story, but he wasn't worth the fuck anything else. Or, you'll hear, lots of stories, women around here, cause he was a bit of a tomcat. That's how he got down. But
yeah,
it was just a thing that growing up here, you just knew, we all knew that there was this sense of there's nothing really here, and we don't really have a future as far as we're all poor kids, but there's cool people that do cool shit that come from here. We would always Tarantino's from here. He's the best at movies. That was back when I still thought that, but still, when you're a young kid in the trailer park and you got, Cormac McCarthy coming from the area, and the all the old heads around you are always telling stories about him, and the folk he run with, and the history of Knoxville. And then, of course, Sutri being set in Knoxville. And those of us who ended up living on those same roads after the trailer park, you know, there Sutri just hits for you know, if you've been really, 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 really poor in this part of the world, then it speaks to you, you know, it speaks to you real, real hard. And so, yeah, that was kind of honestly what got me into reading stuff like that. I've been told, you know, I needed to get into some Faulkner and things like that, but Cormac is what got me reading, you know, stuff, other stuff like Toni Morrison and Faulkner and Flannery O'Connor. Like I was really, it graduated me. And that's why it's, you know, special to me. Because I feel like it just expanded my, not only was he a hometown hero, but I feel like it unlocked something in my brain. All I'd ever written before that was little, you know, short stories and things like that. I never, you know, I like screenplays and I like short stories, but that showed me like, oh nah, here's, you know, this is a whole different kind of magic.
It's interesting you mentioned Flannery O'Connor, because I lived in Milledgeville for years, and that's the same relationship Milledgeville has with Flannery O'Connor. Milledgeville, Georgia, there's just not a whole lot to claim from Milledgeville, Georgia. There's a college there now that does pretty well, but it didn't used to. But Flannery O'Connor, when she was alive, and now, you know, her grave, everybody, they want to take you there. Everybody wants to talk about that. It's very similar energy to that. So I was thinking about that, but yeah,
absolutely.
To say my own relationship to his work, I've not read all of it. I don't have as deep of a relationship with it, but you know, of course, coming from Tennessee, not the same region as Tennessee, but in Tennessee and Georgia, the Southeast, you know, obviously having that, like, you know, that Southern pride for the good writers that come from the South, you know, some actual decent Southern pride, not the bullshit is all I'm talking about. Y'all know. But you know, for some people that, you know, really know what they're talking about and really can get into that sort of American spirit, in a sort of unique way that I think really writers from the South really can, if they put their minds to it. And I'll say The Road was just, for me in high school, I was, reading The Road. I read it probably the second half of the book. I'd read the first half, the second half of it. I read the whole thing at a wrestling tournament. I love this story. I was at a wrestling tournament. I guess I was not like a WWE. Like I was wrestling, doing high school wrestling. And these wrestling tournaments were like all day affairs, 10, 11, 12 hour affairs. You get there at 8 a.m. You get out 9 or 10 because you're wrestling all day. And you wrestle maybe 3 times in the day, and you just kind of got to be ready. And I remember I read more than half of The Road at this wrestling tournament. And I remember I finished it, and I don't know how long I was basically just looking at a wall, but apparently my coach had to snap in my face and say, Jacob, you're up, you're up. And that was so funny to me, man. And I, for what it's worth, I did win that match. I think that says less about me and more about the guy I was wrestling, but still such a funny story to me. It's just like me at probably 15 years old, just staring at a wall, just like, holy shit, what did I just like deal with? Like, and then all of a sudden getting snapped, my coach, you know, he's like, what do you got there in your face? You got some comic books or something? You know, just, oh man.
Yeah. Funny. That the, what it would do to your head being that age, reading that book, what it would do to your head in that moment, and then be like, oh, now I got to go throw somebody on the mat. Okay, I guess. Jesus. Yeah,
anyway, that's my main background. But I had not read Blood Meridian before this. And I don't know how I missed it, but man, oh man. just incredible, really. But like, let's get into the book. I mean, there's a, you know, as always, we're not really, you know, as always, we're not, you know, if you want to read this book, and we highly encourage it, and you're worried about spoilers, it's a difficult book to spoil, but we're going to go through the plot. I will say, And it's the first thing I kind of wanted to ask about. The beginning of every chapter just tells you what's going to happen in the chapter. And I was interested, like, it just at the beginning just has a list of events. And, you know, it's funny because sometimes you'll read the list of events and it's like, it's all this. It's like 12 pages. And sometimes it'll be like one sentence correlates to one thing. And sometimes the whole chapter will correlate to like one thing in there.
And it'll be like, oh, this guy does. And you're like, fuck.
Yeah.
Like, oh, whoa, like whoa, 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 whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. Or like, I think like four or five times it just says the judge as like at the beginning, or like the judge speaks or something, which
and
I think.
And then judge, the judge prestidigitant.
Yeah. Says, when it says the judge speaks or the judge gives a lesson, you know it's going to be an interesting chapter.
About to get some
shit. Off the bat, what do y'all think about that?
I was going to say, do y'all outline, you're talking about how the chapters are done like that with that sort of outline list at the beginning. Do y'all outline it all when you write?
Oh yeah,
that's what it seems like to me. I know some people just don't fool with it at all. A lot of people just don't fool with it because that's what it seems like to me. That was like his outline or whatever, and he was just like, "Fuck it, that's what I'll title the chapters." Or you know what I'm saying? Like he had all these the things that he wanted to cover, you know, the basic points that he wanted to cover for every chapter, and then he was just like, name of chapters, I'll just put this up there.
It's interesting, like, because the way I kind of saw it is like, yeah, I agree, it's something along those lines, but I think it's also a sort of a situation where you're going into it and it's like, it's not about the plot in the sense of like, ooh, what's gonna happen. Like, yeah. The book basically is just like, they're all gonna die, dude. Like, at the beginning.
Yeah, you know it.
Like, they're all gonna, like, and also if you know your history, you know, like, it's just a bloodbath. Like,
oh,
it's just,
yes.
Like, if you know anything about the history of it at all, and these characters, a couple of them are based on maybe real people, but like, I just mean the history of the region,
right?
You just know, like, there is no good outcome here. Nobody's walking away clean. Really, nobody's walking away at all, except for the judge, which we'll talk about. I mean, he's dancing away, but
he's dancing.
Always dancing.
But yeah, the book is essentially, It opens up with, I guess, our protagonist, though there's chapters at a time where he just kind of like gets mentioned like twice, but you got the kid and he never has a name. McCarthy likes to do that, does the same thing in The Road with the father and son, but you got the kid and he's a young man. He's sort of pseudo protagonist. He's this Tennessean. His mother died in childbirth and he's 13 or 14 years old? And he flees to Texas.
14,
yeah.
And we don't really know much about, like, I mean, what we know about him is he's a bad kid. He comes from a bad home. He's poor. He has nothing better to do than, you know, first go to New Orleans and then to Texas. And he just sort of leaves violence in his wake. He's a shit kid and was raised to be a shit kid. But he's real good. He's really good at fighting. He's really good at killing people when he needs to. He never gets called anything but the kid until the end when they just call him the man when he's an adult. Mm-hmm.
Interesting how it sets that up in the beginning, you know, because it breezes through a lot of stuff. But it is, but like the things it makes a point to establish, you know what I mean? In that first little bit, he, you know, engages in violence and feels himself vindicated. You know, mention of introduction to racism, obviously, you know, being a big part of his world. You know, these things are like set right in the beginning. But again, even what I think is really interesting is like, you're told about the kid's violence.
Yeah.
You know, but you're not seeing him participate in it. You're not seeing him as a, you know, as he's actually doing it. So there's this weird little disconnect with the kid and the violence. And that's like three things that get established like right there off the rip that, you know, I feel like are super important, you know, to the whole thing throughout.
If I'm right, the first time he does violence, is it when he like gets in his fight with Toadvine? Maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and even then, you know,
He's always not the instigator in that situation.
He's always at depicted as just doing what he has to do to protect himself from the violence, you know, and it's still never, you know, talked about as he's actually doing it. You never actually see him do it. And it makes it really, really, really a lot more interesting, in my opinion.
I mean, I think he even sees everything he does in the whole novel as like, oh, well, it's just kind of what I got to do, man. Like, it's he doesn't have this like will to violence in the same way some of the other characters do. Like, don't get me wrong, like he's like a nasty son of a bitch, but like he doesn't have this like the way Holden or Glanton, like, or Toad Vine, right, or any of them are like, let's go get them, let's whatever. Like, he'll shoot, he'll stab, he'll be there. He's at a lot of incidents where it's not really clear who did the killing, but like it was probably him. But like he's just kind of like, he almost is, it feels like, and it's hard to get in his head, but he's kind of a passive observer almost of his own life. And that's not to, you know, say that he's not, you know, guilty of doing horrible, awful things, but that he is, you know, just like the sort of cast off riffraff of this country that the country builds and makes with the intention of shipping off west to go fight these battles. Like there's an assembly line of little kids getting sent off to Texas to go fight and die.
And
just drown our enemies in blood.
Yeah, you know, before and after, because I mean, I'm just looking at the first paragraph here. Right. The outside lie dark turned fields with rags of snow and darker woods beyond that harbor yet a few last wolves, which, I mean, you get the sense. I mean, I'm glad that y'all brought up his origins early on and how that kind of skews things. Right. Because you get a sense that he's born in the ashes of this battle that's kind of been fought to establish where he is, you know, because before it was fighting wolves, before it was taming the very wilderness. Right. And for somebody who, you know, has a taste for mindless violence from a very early age, right? The question is, okay, well, if not here, where is he going to find his fight?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I mean, and it's also, you said that, you know, the violence already is established in where he lives. I mean, it's also worth noting this takes place, I mean, essentially immediately after the Mexican-American War. Like in the immediate aftermath. Which is an interesting choice. You'd think off the time period, it's like, okay, it's a book about the Mexican-American War, but talks about it basically none. despite it's of course, it's an ever-present thing, but it's interesting. McCarthy isn't choosing a distinct period of a violent outbreak. You know, he's not choosing the Mexican-American War. He's not choosing the Civil War. He's not even choosing any specific, like, periods of large engagement between colonialists and American Indians, right? Like, he's not even picking like one of the big incidents we put in our head. Cause like the way just people think is like, we like to break things down as isolated incidents. We like to be like, okay,
that's a great point. Yeah.
Yeah. There was the French and Indian War. That was one of our fights with American Indians. And there was Wounded Knee. That was one of our fights. But McCarthy is like, no, man, this went on every day for 200, 300 years.
Yes. Yes.
That's what he really wants you to remember is he goes, every day, it's just another thing of bodies. And they just got their blood laid on the sand. And as it even describes later in the book, the sun made it as if it had never been there before. And this was every day. This isn't a special day. This is just another day in Texas.
You just said that. Yeah. This is not a special day. This is not a special. And I think there's a that's, you know, a lot of people complain about the monotony of this book, the monotony of the violence. But I think that is on purpose because of what you're talking about. You know what I'm saying? Like the whole goal was to put like reality to the violence. And get rid of all the pomp and circumstance and you know, show that it's just everyday shit that becomes completely for those, you know, who engage in it regularly and people just turn into meat and receipts, you know.
And
there was a guy online who complained. He said, why did this, and it was just some dumbass, but he said, like, why does this book not mention the Alamo once? And I was like,
excuse me, what?
I thought that was the funniest, unintentionally funniest thing. I was like, man,
what, this is 11-12 years hence? Like,
it's like he was doing it like it needs to be like out of respect for our brave troops or whatever. I was like, dude, you think McCarthy gives a shit about your brave troops?
And talk about missing the points, like, yeah, so comprehensively, like, because I mean, because that's the thing, like, it's any the judge says at one point, I'm thinking right now, and this is skipping ahead a whole hell of a lot, but he says that, look, you know, the mystery of life, the mystery of the universe is that there is no mystery, mm-hmm. right? You know, any kind of meaning that you kind of overlay on any kind of narrative that makes sense of it all, it's in retrospect, and it's, you know, you can't make sense of your own mind, right? Because your own mind is all you have to make sense of it with, right? So, and that's the thing, right? So to set it during the war, I think, is, well, I'll come at it from a different perspective, right? To set it after the war is to sort of put the lie to any idea of there being an after, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah,
because, the border is not established. The frontier is still very, porous and kind of fuzzy. And, right. To the degree that colonization has come to this land, it's still very much authority is still very much in flux, and the West hasn't quote unquote been won yet, and indeed it's often described as an anti-Western, because again, it sort of puts the lie to the fact that that anything can be won.
And if you look at the time when it came out, that was when the big hero Westerns were coming out, like, were really popular. If you were reading Westerns, you were reading, the big hero stuff, the stuff that was, made to be. And this is my favorite thing about Cormac's stories altogether, is that real life is not tied up nice and tight. There's no story arc in real life. It's just a series of events. This is what happened. It's not going to wrap up nice and neat for you or whatever. And again, it goes back to, why he said it when he did, the place that he said it in. It's just like, you couldn't, it seems to me he was really trying hard to be like, hey, that silly hero Western bullshit, I promise you it wasn't like that. I promise you it wasn't like that. I'll write you a book that what the West was really like, and you're not gonna like it. that's the way it feels.
One thing that I think is interesting, and you're talking about, it's not like nothing's framed nicely, or nothing's framed in like perfect time periods, exactly how much time, exactly where's what, exactly where does this tie into history, it dances around. And even moments where people in the novel, and it gives a couple of years, but even moments in the novel where people point out, like, oh, well, it says he was, it says the kid was born during the Leonid's meteor shower, right? In 1833. Yeah. And the funny thing is that about that is, and this took me a little bit of looking, but that's actually a reference to a William Faulkner novel. He's referencing the novel Go Down Moses when he references the 1833 meteor shower.
Really?
It's about, because that's the same night that a slave, like this slave in that same novel dies, that he would have been reading around the same time. And it's, he uses the exact same language in one of the quotes in him quoting about why our stars fell. It's like an exact same quote. So even that, he's like doing this framing off of this other like literary tradition, and also this like history of slavery. You were talking about the violence that gave birth to him. You can almost literally see it as the kid was born out of the blood of like slave violence.
Damn, that's crazy. Yeah.
Just layers to that shit, dude.
God damn, dude.
It's too good, man.
It's too good. Like, honestly, it pisses me off sometimes.
It is one hell of a baptism. Holy, I can't believe you found that.
Yeah, that's cool.
I had thought I had heard that quote somewhere else. I went down and then I realized on the whatever. But anyway, it founds your point so well. Is like, it's even history is like a set piece here, like He's moving around like action figures to make a point. It's not like he picked out some characters like Glanton and Judge Holden, not because of what they did or didn't do, even though these were presumably some real outlaws, but because they fit right into the right moment, just like he's fit in this meteor shower because it works both historically and literarily. But it all kind of locks together in this interesting way.
Yeah, that is really cool.
And none of it's by accident, that's for sure.
Nope.
He was sitting in that stone hut behind a supermarket, just racking his brain to make everything of just this perfect puzzle, going crazy because he hated the place he was staying in, and just like putting all his spite into this crazy ass
mouth full of beans.
Yes, exactly. Like, just chewing mad as hell. Exactly right. But yeah. Plot wise, so have we even gotten to him meeting the judge? I don't think we have.
I was just thinking about the judge when
talked about it. Like the judge, he meets the judge first at that like church hall or that church tent, right?
There's like a revival going on, yeah. And and the judge steps up, right? And he points at the reverend and he says, "Hey, this guy has this guy's guilty of bestiality. This guy's guilty of raping children. All this, that, and the other horrible thing." And then this dude gets run out of town.
Yep. And it turns out like the judge was just like making shit up. Like he by his own admission.
I never laid eyes on the man before today. Never even heard of him.
And the people who drove the guy out of town start laughing when they heard that. Like, they're just like, "Oh man, you got us." And it's like, that dude's some retarded and feathered. Like, but the judge is interesting. He's described as a 7 foot tall, pale, hairless man, like literally hairless, not just on his head, but like when he's naked, like just not a hair on his body. Dude's got this huge like smile. Like, he's strong as hell. Like, there's even a part in it where he's like picks up a meteor ore, and like even his own guys are like, "There's no way he can throw that thing." He throws it like 10 feet. Like,
oh, he's
supernatural. I mean, we could say he's supernatural. To what extent is a little unclear, but he is very well spoken, very grammatically sharp, got this deep, strong voice, kind of imagining like almost like a James Earl Jones or something like that, this deep, powerful voice. And he's good at just about everything. He's like perfect at everything, really. Speaks every language, knows everything, analyzes everything, is obsessive. He can dance, he can play music, he knows law. It's not really clear what he's the judge of until a lot later. he can kill really effectively. He can do magic tricks. I mean, like the dude knows everything about everything.
He knows geology. He knows, weather and
he's a chemist.
He's a chemist. He knows the ins and outs about the native peoples,
fluent Spanish,
politics like it's he does it all.
When people try and like, and people like note that, like the pastor or the ex pastor, like even talks about him like in a fearful way. He's like, "I don't know." He says the man shoots better than anyone I've ever met, but he can dance and play like the fiddle. Like, I don't know what we're looking at right now. Like, this guy's a freak.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. He's like Uncle Fester playing Lurch with like Gomez's personality.
There you go.
I don't know why Adam's Family just popped into my head.
There is it's interesting. Like a lot of, like they've got, I mean, there's been a lot of failed film adaptations of this in the sense that they've tried to make a movie and it's not happened. There was famously Ridley Scott was going to make a movie of this and it didn't happen. And they're working on one now. And me and Josh were saying the other day, who the hell do you get to play Judge Holden? And I did.
Dude, Dave Bautista, I'm telling you.
I mean, maybe, but like, maybe.
You know what?
See,
Bautista does got some chops. I ain't gonna act like he don't got chops. But
Blade Runner 2049, he kind of surprised me with that quiet. I mean,
he's got chops. But
we'll see.
D'Onofrio, it was maybe, but I think he might be too old now. A younger D'Onofrio, muscled up a little bit, I think could do it. D'Onofrio gets weird. He knows how to get weird.
Mm.
So that would have been my. That would have been my guess. That would be my,
honestly, my just like forward. Bring back Javier Bardem from playing Anton Chigurh in No Country for Old Men. Just shave him.
Just shave him.
be good enough for that. But yeah, no. So you've got, and the judge is really this other vital character, because he's just kind of always around. He's a supernatural feeling figure. Whether he literally is or isn't, you know, you can decide that yourself. But he is this figure of this just deep, unsettling evil that sits over this novel. And so the kid, after this, he doesn't know what to do. He ends up falling in with this ex-professional soldier, Captain White. He's like an American supremacist, and he's like, we got to conquer Mexico, as if they didn't just steal like half of Mexico. He's basically the kind of guy who says, like, one of the like Gulf War veterans who was like, if we had only gone further, or the Vietnam veterans who said, if we'd only dropped the atomic bomb, you know, like if we'd only done a little more, it was those libs in Washington that stopped us from winning. He's like that, but for like the 19th century. And he puts together just this gang of real freaks to basically try and go take back Mexico with just like a few guys.
Yeah,
and it goes about as well as you'd expect.
Which, like, and that's we should stress, like, back then that was something people actually did. That's what filibustering meant originally.
Yeah,
was you get a bunch of lowlifes together and you go off and you carve out a fiefdom, and then you turn around and swear allegiance to the United States. William Walker was the most famous of these guys. He was briefly president of Nicaragua. Famously, the only American to ever become head of state of another country, and
William Walker. Way to do it.
William Walker,
Nicaragua.
Yes,
Jesus.
It doesn't sound like he belongs there. I gotta say,
no.
Oh no, no. He kind of walked in there and just didn't walk out.
But yeah,
important to the whole like setting in general, like just the mindset of the time, and it would have been totally understandable for a boy from the volunteer state, you know what I mean? Like, this is what, this is what you're still being told back east. You know, this is, and honestly, I'd say the longest part of history, you know, and still to this day for poor kids, like you were saying before, it's just like, you better take some war and somewhere, buddy, and make something in this world.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's exactly what they did. And it's interesting the difference, you know, or the, cause you've already been introduced to this figure of the judge or whatever, and not really knowing much about him, but, Captain White is, and his mission, what he's doing is put in a very obviously like, this boy's biting off more than he can chew type of light. You see him as like running on ignorance, and especially being a modern audience, you're like, this fucking dude.
Have y'all if I think that this would be a good time, if has anyone got it as their quote, because I don't want to steal, if not I was going to read the quote from the Mennonite before they go on their
my second choice.
Okay, if it's not your first choice, I've got a first choice already, but I'm going to read this just because it's worth going.
Hit it.
Just for context, before they go on this doomed quest, they come across this guy at the saloon. You know, the kid and a few of his friends, and he's just looking at him basically. And he says, the Mennonite watches the enshadowed dark before them as it is reflected to him in the mirror over the bar. He turns to them. His eyes are wet. He speaks slowly. The wrath of God lies sleeping. It was hid a million years before men were, and only men have power to wake it. Hell ain't half full. Hear me. You carry a war of a madman's making onto a foreign land, you'll wake more than the dogs.
That's
fucking and then good. And before the night is out, one of those three guys is dead. The Mennonite just kind of gives him a tip of his hat and walks away.
Yep. That's such a great scene, man. A great scene.
You'll wake more than the dogs. That's so good. And the dogs do remain important in the rest of the book. So.
They do. And as does that philosophy, you know, that thing, you know, that theme, that is it right there. You know, it's there's always going to be the motherfuckers taking that war, and they're always going to find You know, they're always going to find some version of it, and most of the time they're not going to like what they find.
Wonder why they chose Mennonite. I guess it doesn't really matter, but
that is interesting, isn't it? I don't know if it's one of those things like he just an interesting, you know, denomination you don't hear about very often or what. I don't know. I've wondered that too.
I mean, they do tend to be known as pacifists, I guess, or the Anabaptists do. So I guess that
makes sense. Yeah.
I guess that's just where it comes from. And
it's,
you know,
also, I wonder, because you do, it is a sort of, it is the sort of person that you see, because the Mennonites, they kind of dress old timey, right? They go around in horse and carriage and whatnot. It's interesting to me that you would see this sort of person in this time and you'd see them today, and there would be some affair, and there would be some stability, right? There would be some continuity in terms of what you would see back then or back now. So then the question becomes, okay, well, how did that stick around, right? How did, you know, it's the sort of person perhaps who didn't focus on going out and making his bones in the desert, killing people or being killed.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good point.
People who survived.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Makes perfect sense. You know, you're getting that bit of wisdom, you know, from the exact type of person that, you know, is the reason that they're
takes his own advice. That
reference would still hit with a modern audience, you know, who still see Mennonites at the same way. That's a really good point. I never thought about that.
So I just looked it up, and there's a decently sized presence still for what Mennonite sects still exist in El Paso, Texas. So it's very possible he was just interacting with folks like that while he's writing the novel.
Yeah.
That popped into my head, and I was like, you know what? I bet. And I looked it up, and there's a handful out there, and a handful is more than there is in most places.
Right.
But to move it along, I mean, and the reason is a lot of this plot is very, as it gets toward the middle, it kind of becomes more mushy in a more intentional way. Like we were talking about, in a repetitive sort of way of slaughter after slaughter. But just to, you know, talk about what happens next, the kid rides out with this group of filibusters. And I mean, they don't even make contact with Mexicans. They lose immediately to Native Americans. They plan to just like steal from some random people, and these people are hanging on the backs of horses. There's hundreds of horses riding. They're hanging on the backs of them, so you don't see them. They just look like a wild horses. And they pop up and just nail them. I mean, just quick as you please. Just down.
Comanches are still to this day regarded as some of the greatest horse archers in human history, right? And they're coming up on these guys on foot, like. So you see that, you're laughing immediately because you know exactly how it's going to go.
I don't even know that they had crossed the border out of Texas at that point. They were close.
They ranged all over Texas, New Mexico, further.
No, I meant the filibuster group was trying to invade Mexico. I don't know that they'd left Texas by the time they died.
Like, oh yeah.
I'm not even sure they made it to the border.
They didn't get very far, I don't think.
Yeah. Like, Texas was still barely, like, the west of it basically was unsettled, or, you know, not what white civilization would have called settled.
Right.
And
I mean, and there had just been this war here too. I mean, it's pretty.
Before that, it talks about it. You know, there had been war there even before the war that just happened. There was war. There was war. You know, and then before, it is a place that, you know, is hard. You know, that's just the way that you got to be hard to live there, especially back then. You know, I don't go to the desert. I will not go to the desert. Never. I have no place in the desert because there's no fucking water there. But I can imagine, you know, already you're a killer, whatever, you're a shady dude. Spend some time out there for a little while. Or if you're just somebody struggling to live, you know what I mean? After a while of living out there, you are going to develop traits that are mm-hmm. very hard. You know, yeah, like
if you're a normal guy, you turn into a bad guy. If you're a bad guy, you turn into a guy who wears ears around his neck.
It's hard. Hard living. You know, hard to survive. You have to kill shit on the.
Yeah, rim. And you have the kid after this battle just struggling. You know, trying to find water. You have these just brutal. There's a lot of real brutal descriptions of this very. It's very beautiful landscape. But it's just knife hard. It's interesting. Yep. It's like the same landscape that gets very beautiful depictions for honestly well-provisioned characters and all the pretty horses get much more harsh depictions for these characters that are poorly provisioned and in such an intense situation. Like, I thought it was interesting. Another thing I wrote down because I just thought it was an interesting quote, right? Like a description of the desert. And this is just a group of them riding in the sun. It says, they rode on and the sun in the east flushed pale streaks of light and then a deeper run of color like blood seeping up in sudden reaches, flaring plane-wise, and where the earth drained up into the sky at the edge of creation, the top of the sun rose out of nothing like the head of a great red phallus until it cleared the unseen rim and sat squat and pulsing and malevolent behind them. The shadows of the smallest stones lay like a pencil lines across the sand, and the shapes of the men and their mounts advance elongate before them like strands of the night from which they'd ridden, like tentacles to bind them to the darkness yet to come. And it's just like the word choice is insane.
You didn't
have
to do that.
Yeah, but it works so well. Like I see it, you know?
Yes.
They're getting fucked by the sun, like literally.
Yep. But the themes, like all of it, And so many times in those kind of descriptions, it'll be calling back to, you know, the themes from before or, you know, drawing the accuracy of the adjectives, giving you the, you know, reminding you of things that he was making a point about, you know, these figures going out into this thing. You know, the black tentacles reaching out into this, you know, landscape. Like, it's just when you know what they're going out there doing, you know what I'm saying? Like, it makes perfect sense. The accuracy on and those kinds of, you think it's just, oh, he's just trying to paint a cool picture, but it ain't just that. Like, there's
also later on, a few chapters later on, you have the judge give a speech about everything is tied to things. Everything is tethered. They're tentacled. Mm-hmm. And he says, I've got this coin. Heavenly bodies do it, and so do men. And it's the same way. You've got these tendrils that are tying them backward.
Yep.
Every man tabernacled on every other, he in exchange, and so on, in an endless complexity of being and witness to the uttermost edge of the world.
Mm-hmm. Jesus, exactly right,
man. Mm-hmm. Ah, damn. Yeah, that old boy can say it. He knows how to say it.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, the kid ends up getting falling in he falls into the village. He gets taken prisoner by the Mexican army and basically gets turned over to this gang of desperados. Led by none other than John Joel Glanton. The way he's okay, we mentioned it briefly earlier, but there's this guy named Toadvine that the kid got in a fight with back in the day. They both kind of lost the fight, and there was like sort of, I guess, a mutual respect that Toadvine developed. The kid doesn't seem to really care one way or another, but Toadvine gets him out of the scrape, and they're going to work on this gang of people that are contracted to hunt down American Indians. They're basically getting paid by the scalp, and particularly to hunt down like different leaders of like particular like value. You know, they're outlaws, they're bounty hunters, but they're right now they're kind of privateers for different like different cities and stuff. Whoever's gonna pay them, they're gonna kill for them.
Yeah, and like notably, the last time we've seen Toadvine, I think, is sorry to cut you off. Once he and the kid have kind of skipped town, right? And they skipped town because Toadvine had this grudge he was settling of some indeterminate nature with a guy, and he woke him up by lighting a fire in his room at the tavern he was staying at. And then the whole thing just kind of burns down and they book it. That's how he solves problems.
Yeah.
My favorite thing about what he's talking about, old brass teeth, you know, especially if you've been locked up, you know that you pick out one of the COs and you're like, God damn, I hope I can get along with him one good time. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, just give me a minute. If I can catch him in the cut, ain't nobody around. And it's so fucking relatable. Wait, somebody's like, yeah, and I'm gonna get them gold teeth and it's gonna fetch me a pretty penny. You know, that's just that. I know, I feel like one of Cormac's homies from running the roads here in Knoxville. That was inspired, but I know dudes like that. I grew up with dudes like that.
It's worth noting too, Toadvine, he's one of the, like, there's some ugly dudes in this novel, but Toadvine's described as having brands and he's described as having no ears. Just a real ropey black hair. Just a real
looking dude.
He's really seen it. The adventures of Toadvine before this are probably just as bad as everything.
Oh God, yeah.
Man, I watched The Adventures of Toadvine.
Yep. Shoot. Absolutely. Yeah.
But yeah, so they become this group that they're following this guy, John Joel Glanton. He's the American leader, the captain of this gang of scalp hunters. And Judge Holden has sort of been taken on as his lieutenant. They find out later that Judge Holden, he fell in with them when they were about to die, and he basically taught them how to make gunpowder out of just different materials in the earth and stuff. And he did some like borderline like alchemy shit, like dark magic,
sulfur, saltpeter, and charcoal.
That is, though, that's fucking alchemy, bro.
Yeah,
the way he did it on a volcano. Yeah.
Yeah, the volcano, and he's pouring it. And
piss on these rocks. Trust me, it'll work.
Yeah. And the judge, this thing. Is the second time the kid has seen him, and it notes later on that everybody in the gang somewhere in their life had encountered the judge before they became part of this gang, which I thought was notable.
I think that is very notable because he's very careful throughout on with the supernatural stuff with the judge.
Mm-hmm.
And because how he designed the character, he made him capable of a lot of things that would seem supernatural to us.
Right.
Like a man can learn a bunch of languages. A man can know all that stuff. A man can play the fiddle and dance and practice law and, you know how to make gunpowder by pissing on a volcano. That's doable. A man can be big and super strong. The thing about every person there swears they met him before is, I think, one of the most, like, the strongest he really goes at that supernatural claim. But the way he goes about it, to put it out there like he is supernatural, but the way he puts it out there is that you hear about it secondhand from people just being like, oh yeah, everybody says they've seen him before.
The ex-priest basically, when the kid says, yeah, I've seen before, the ex-priest is kind of like, yeah, bullshit, man. Whatever.
Exactly. Everybody says that. Yeah.
So, and, you know, in his own head, he's like, yeah, I'm the only one that's met him before. You
know? Right. It's so interesting. I think it was very deliberate to do that. And I've always, it's something I always come back to, because there's, you know, the big debate on, is he the devil? But that's one of the things I always come back to. That's one of the things that was really stretching that. Because everything else is somewhat plausible for the
most part. The other thing that it ties to is he tells a story at one point that it seems to mess with a lot of the guys. Like, a lot of the guys, like, it ties to something in their own lives.
Yeah.
And I find that to be another interesting point where he's got this insight. But then again, you could say, well, maybe he's a keen listener. He wove a story together that would get under all their skin. You know, like.
And he's been traveling with these dudes for a while now. He's got them. That he's definitely a dude that just. He has all the skill set to enthrall men.
Honestly, if you think about it, I'll bet you, I won't bet you, but I could see Cormac McCarthy, half the reason he just didn't want to take interviews is he's like, I don't want to answer who the judge is. And you know, that's all they're going to ask me.
I could see that.
Yep. For years after this book, you know, all they're going to ask him. All right. So Judge Holden.
Yeah. What exactly went on here? Because, I mean, you know, there is a lot of that. There's a lot that's another thing that I love about this book.
And there is a lot going on. And then The character of Glanton, there's not, he's, I think at first you don't see it, but they describe it at one point as like kind of insane or mad is the word they use. He's not mad in the sense he's just like a stark raving lunatic, but he is a guy that has somehow, and we know he was he's a veteran of previous wars and stuff. He's just like a complete sociopath. Like he has nothing. Yeah. And not like born a sociopath. Like he is a guy who has like molded himself into a sociopath, like through decision after decision. He is like the biblical Pharaoh who chose to harden his heart. Like,
he is
in that way. Like he has been made that, and he is a captain of the American military. He fought in the Mexican-American War, won respect, whatever that means, doing that. We know the dude is a damn good fighter. I mean, with these old ass guns, he's doing shots from like 200 yards.
Oh yeah, he's calling the Indians' moves as they make them.
Yeah,
yeah, he's quick, he's whatever, and he's like, yeah, he is. So he's kind of your like ultimate killer or whatever. And it's interesting because the judge, he's like a guy that you'd think the judge would like have problems like taking second fiddle to, but the judge really doesn't ever seem to have a problem, and he doesn't really undermine Glanton. He just, because Glanton's kind of already doing what the judge wants to happen.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's another thing that I think is really interesting about the dynamic of the gang. Again, at every turn, Cormac is, this is not your Western that you've read before. You know what I mean? Like, because you, is Glanton calling shots, or is the judge influencing him in every little thing that he does? And that's up to you to decide, really. And like, because they both have this, they both understand the game, but they both understand the game of what it is. And Glanton is like, military racist, you know, yeah. He's like, whereas the judge is like, college educated, I got my calipers out racist.
Yeah, he's doing like a weird, like, yeah.
You and me were like the other day, oh, is the judge a liberal? Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Again, like, it's very, because that's one thing you get a lot of, and most mentions of Glanton, his racism is a big part of who he is. You know, like, that's, and I'm surprised that I don't hear people talk about the racial dynamics in Blood Meridian more.
Yeah, and that was the thing I wanted to get into at a certain point. And it's worth pointing out.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, there is literally a white versus black story in this fucking thing, straight up. You know what I mean? Like, told, I mean, you rarely hear folks talk about it. I've heard a few people talk about it, but it's one of the things about Glanton that if you're going to talk about Glanton, it informs everything about his character. What he sees everybody that ain't white as, you know,
that savages. Particular, yeah, mm-hmm.
That's it, straight up. And it don't matter what brand they are, they all get called the same thing, you know.
Yeah, he's even sus on Bathgap because he's from Wales. Like,
yep.
He's looking at him. He's like, all right, he's a Welsh guy. I'm not so sure about, like, he's advanced racist. Like,
on that next level shit.
Yeah. And the book is like, it's notable that the way McCarthy writes is thought and prose and even dialogue are blended together. Like, he's not using quotation marks and he's not using italics to say, this is a thought. And he's not even very often saying he thought this. It's all just kind of this soup almost that he throws everything together. And you got to figure out, sometimes you got to pull out what's a word, what's a thought, what's a this, what's a that. So a lot of his prose is like happening. It's the characters' heads are coloring like the perception. So when the prose can refer to, you know, native people as savages, it can use slurs, it can use this kind of stuff because it is like colored by the brains of these characters. Like, And it's even shown to not always be accurate. Sometimes it'll go, there's one part where it says there were five thistles in the bush. No, seven thistles on the bush. Like, how often do you have a narrator, like a third person omniscient narrator, say correct itself? It's happened multiple times in the book. It is all colored by the just like the weird soup of these people's brains, and everybody who's in focus on screen, if this were a movie, is kind of just their collective psyche is sort of forming this it's not one narrator, which is interesting. And it's certainly not the kid. The kid is certainly not, especially later on, certainly not the main mind this is being drawn from, which I find interesting.
It's it mixes in Spanish as well. Which, you know, if you don't speak Spanish, it might be disorienting at first, you know.
And to be fair, most of it's like pretty basic.
Well, yeah, exactly. And you know, for even the stuff that's not, I feel like, and I'm working on distant memory of high school Spanish here, but I feel like you can kind of infer it from context clues once you get immersed enough in it. You know,
if you don't know what they're saying, it says, okay, then he gestured at the horse and he brought the horse over, you know?
Right.
But you just said it. I don't know. For me, it feels like it makes the immersion easier.
I agree.
You know, like it when you don't have the quotations and you don't have all the extra stuff that's separating these things. Oh, this is what somebody's saying. This is what somebody's thinking. Like you said, with this soup, the soup is more immersive to me. Mm-hmm. You know, because of that, and it seems more realistic, you know, because of the language it uses in that way.
Yeah, I agree. It's just, it's a thing that you can't thumb through, you know, you kind of got to, well, no. You can, but like, it's very difficult. You know, you got to bring a lot of yourself and a lot of your own mind, and you got to reckon with the work, which I think is a sign a lot of times of great literature. Not that there's anything wrong with more poppy stuff that you can fold. We both liked, Joss and I both liked Gideon the Ninth. You could kind of fly through Gideon the Ninth, the book we read. This book, though, you kind of got to put a little bit of your soul into it, like, which also makes you kind of have to come away with this, like, you know, you've put your brain into the muck that is this book, and you've got like some of that muck sticking to you, and you kind of got to work through it and think through it. The words of the judge are echoing in your ears, you know?
Yeah, that's a really good way of saying it.
It's like, I read somebody who just was like, who described Cormac McCarthy. Oh, I think it was David Foster Wallace writing about this book in his essay in the 90s. He called this book haunted. And I can really feel that.
Yeah, not haunting, haunted.
No, as in there is a ghost and it, like, haunt. Yeah, it's following you home. It's in the room. Right. And I absolutely see that. It's 100%. I also wanted to, one more thing on the sort of not that it can't come back up, but on the, like, his decisions with language and the decision to, you know, go for it, and he does use slurs, he does whatever, like, I think it's interesting. It reminds me of a teacher I had in college, right? Professor I had in college, and we were talking about books, and there was this student, and I won't say his name in case whatever someone knows who he is. He was a real piece of work, but he said to his teacher, and he was real mad that he had an essay rejected, and he said, "You can't write anything anymore." And the teacher looked and he goes, "You can write anything if it's good. Like, you're allowed to say whatever you want if it's good." And I thought that was so true.
Yep.
And he made that point. I'm like, Cormac McCarthy, like, people aren't like, cause the intent is clear, you know, like,
right. Exactly.
And to be clear, this student, and I mean, if someone was in this class, they'll know who I'm talking about, said, was mad because he wrote a paper or not paper, an essay about why there are no good girls anymore and nobody would publish it. And he was mad about that. And it's like, well, maybe what you're writing sucks, man. Like, I don't know what to tell you. And like, that was what the professor, like, you know, while being professional, kind of told him, you know, like, he was like, man, like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, you know, he's like, so like, it was, and I came back to that thinking about this book.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I wonder if that's part of what we've been talking about with why Cormac didn't, you know, want to explain any of this stuff. You know, he didn't want to have to answer. He's like, yes, I wrote it like that. I use those words because that is the way it was. That is the reality. You know, this is the way most white people talked. You know, they would have been in that situation.
Yes.
This is the way they were. They're,
yes.
If I'm going to put you, and that's a problem you have with other Westerns. It's like, oh, good thing we're following the only non-racist former Confederate in this Western.
Yeah, like, the good old Lone Ranger who would never speak ill. Like, come on.
Yeah, the honorable, you know, former Confederate general in, you know, the remake of Magnificent Seven, right?
Oh, yeah.
Who, you know, yeah, never said a slur, you know, and, even though he fought for that one ridiculous side. And that's the thing. Like, it's it's the brutality that this book is shot through with, and it's what men are capable of descending to in this context and in this territory, right? There is a context to these sorts of things, right? And there is a way of looking at the world and of looking at people who are fundamentally different from you in such a way that they are no longer rendered as people in your thinking. And it's in that context that you can, you know, double fist babies and slam them against the ground until they die.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I mean, go ahead. Sorry. I was just going to say,
you know, when you, the things you can descend to, what men are capable of in that, you know, in that realm, but also the monotony of it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like the
banality.
Yeah. It feels like the place has a lot to do with it, obviously. And you know, the backgrounds, I guess, I'll say the quote that I picked, it fits here. So I'll just go ahead and say it. It's real simple. Two words: darkness implacable. Mm. I think is the best sentence in this. It's just a two word sentence. And it's so perfect. It's a part of that main theme of you know, what if you are somebody who lives in a place where you feel you are at war all the time, and what that does to your brain. And like, I think that was one of the main reasons why it, you know, of course it doesn't compare, but the trailer park kids that I grew up with, you know, most of us, a lot of us were homeless. I was homeless before I finished high school. My best buddy Savage was homeless not too long after, on the run from the law. Mm-hmm. All of us, you know, during the opioid crisis is when we were in high schools, like the biggest part of it. And all of us were living on the street, selling dope, committing violence on a regular basis. Because it was just a normal part of life for us. It was every day. Somebody was fighting every day, and nasty, you know, people were getting stabbed. People were getting shot at. But what your brain does after so long of that, you know what I mean? Like what your brain turns into, how you feel of when you feel like, just for lack of a better comparison, feeling like you are in enemy territory all the time. Like there is always, at everywhere you are, you have to be ready to punk not a motherfucker's head, you know, right then at the drop. And every interaction you have with anybody, most of those interactions are, well, a lot of them, especially if it's another man, he's going to come with a little bit of force. And if you don't respond with the proper amount of force, then, you know, that can affect your life, not only in that situation, but, you know, how you survive from then on out. Like, what the processes that it turns on in your head, these kind of animalistic, violent, but then kind of glazing your eyes over to them at the same time. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it's a weird thing that happens. And this book captures it perfectly. And I could feel it. Sometimes when I'm reading it, I get that same feeling that I would have, you know, when I was, you know, living rough and cocking the pistol every time I answered my door, you know what I'm saying? Afraid either the police or somebody's going to come in and, you know, take all my pills or whatever. Like, it hits so hard if you've experienced extended periods of violence like that or living like that. And like, you see how much of a point he was trying to make with every one of these characters and all of their traits.